Historian Bernard Lewis writes that the traditional Islamic view, upheld by the vast majority of jurists and commentators, is that jihad usually refers to an armed struggle against infidels and apostates. Lewis writes, "In the Muslim worldview, the basic division of mankind is into the House of Islam, Dar al-Islam, and the House of War, Dar al-Harb. Ideally, the House of Islam is conceived as a single community. The logic of Islamic law, however, does not recognize the permanent existence of any other polity outside Islam. In time, in the Muslim view, all mankind will accept Islam or submit to Islamic rule. A treaty of peace between the Muslim state and a non-Muslim state was thus, in theory, impossible." Such a truce, according to the jurists, could only be provisional. The name given by the Muslim jurists to this struggle is jihad. The clear implication of Lewis' remarks is that the terrorists who profess the name of Allah and proclaim jihad are operating squarely within the Islamic tradition. Indeed, they are performing what Islam has typically held to be a religious duty. Of course, it could be pointed out that there are many millions of Muslims who do not agree with this view of Islam. They prefer what may be termed the jihad of the heart, or perhaps the jihad of the pen, to the jihad of the sword. But traditionally, Islam has embraced all these forms of jihad as legitimate, so that the only reasonable conclusion is that many Muslims today, both in the West and in the Islamic world, no longer profess Islam in its traditional sense. In a word, they are liberals, not in the Michael Dukakis connotation, but in the classic meaning of the term. From the point of view of the bin Ladens of the world, these people are apostates for diluting the faith and refusing to do battle against the infidels. I realize that terms like apostate and infidel sound harshly unfamiliar to the Western ear. There is something strange and antique about them, as if they belong to the world of our ancestors. And of course, they do. 1,000 years ago, during the time of the Crusades, the ancestors of the West understood their Islamic foe very well. Nobody spoke of the West at that time. They spoke of Christendom. It was a time, one may say, when the Christians, too, had their jihad, and it was aimed at the reconquest of the Holy Land. For Christians, the Crusades combined two traditional practices, pilgrimage and holy war. Kings and popes alike proclaimed that those who died in battle were martyrs for the faith and would go straight to heaven. There are important differences, of course, between Islam and Christianity, and the religious armies who faced each other in the 11th and 12th centuries were very conscious of them. But they were also conscious of the deep similarities between the two faiths. Islam and Christianity are both monotheistic, the only two religions that can truly be called universal. Judaism is a religion for God's chosen people, and God's instructions are intended for them, not for anyone else. Hinduism is largely confined to India and the surrounding areas. Buddhism has longer tentacles, but it too is largely an Asian religion, with a few adherents in the West. Confucianism is not really a religion, and in any case, it has a limited reach. Christianity and Islam, by contrast, believe in a universal truth, handed down by God, that is true for all people, in all places, at all times. Believing themselves in possession of this exclusive truth, Christians and Muslims have historically sought to inform the whole world of their truth, and to bring them to the one true faith. During the Crusades, they both had a name for each other, infidel. It was the same name, and both sides interpreted it the same way. Islam and Christianity clashed, not because they failed to understand each other, but because they understood each other perfectly well. But a lot has happened since the 12th century, and we have forgotten a lot of things. American culture is rather present-oriented, and even what happened in the 1980s now seems dated. It is time we started to learn and to remember, because our enemies do. When bin Laden invokes the name of Saladin, he is drawing inspiration from the great 12th century Muslim general who threw back the Crusades and recaptured Jerusalem. In his videotaped statement, released on Al Jazeera television, bin Laden said Americans should get used to suffering because our Islamic nation has been tasting the same for more than 80 years. He was referring to the dismembering of the Ottoman Empire, the last of the great Muslim empires, by the victorious European forces after World War I. Say what you will about the terrorists. They know who they are and where they are coming from. And behind their physical attack on America and the West is an intellectual attack, one that we should understand and be prepared to answer. One reason the terrorist assault startled Americans so much is that it occurred at a time when American ideas and American influence seemed to be spreading irresistibly throughout the world. The zeitgeist was captured by Francis Fukuyama in his best-selling book The End of History and the Last Man. Fukuyama argued that the world was moving decisively in the direction of liberal, capitalist democracy. In Fukuyama's view, history had ended not in the sense that important things would cease to happen, but in the sense that the grand ideological conflicts of the past had been forever settled. Of course, the pace of liberalization would vary, but the outcome was inevitable. The destiny of Homo sapiens had been resolved. We were headed for what may be termed Planet America. Fukuyama's thesis, advanced in the early 1990s, seemed consistent with the remarkable events going on in the world. The collapse of the Soviet Union left America as the world's sole superpower, with unrivaled military superiority. The discrediting of socialism meant that there was no conceivable alternative to capitalism, and all the countries of the world seemed destined to be integrated into a single global economy. Dictatorships crumbled in many parts of the world, especially in Eastern Europe and Latin America, and were replaced by democratic regimes. America launched the Silicon Revolution and continues to dominate the world in technology. And American ideas and American culture have captured the imagination of young people around the world and made deep inroads into previously remote outposts in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East. These are undeniable and hugely important facts, but the complacent confidence of the Planet America thesis has been shaken. The Cold War is over, and yet the world has become a more dangerous place. Americans, never particularly attentive to the rest of the world, have become acutely aware that there are powerful currents of resistance to globalization and Americanization. There are lots of people who do not want to become like us, and many people, especially in the Muslim world, apparently hate our guts and want to wipe us off the face of the earth. This realization for Americans comes as a surprise. In his 1997 book, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, Samuel Huntington warned that America and the West should not arrogantly assume that the rest of the world would uncritically embrace the principles of Judeo-Christian civilization. Huntington disputed the thesis of the end of history and pointed out that the great victories won in recent years by liberalism and democracy were mainly in Latin America and Eastern Europe, regions of the world that were within the traditional orbit of the Judeo-Christian West. Huntington argued that in the post-Cold War world, the most dangerous conflicts would occur across the fault lines between the world's major civilizations. Huntington identified civilizations mainly in terms of religion, Hindu civilization, Confucian civilization, Islamic civilization. Given the deep differences among these religious tribes, Huntington predicted that they were bound to quarrel. So who is right, Fukuyama or Huntington? This is one of the questions that this book will try to answer. But first, let us examine the three main currents of foreign opposition to the spread of American influence. First, the European school. Actually, this may be more precisely described as the French school, although it has sympathizers in other European countries. The French seem to be outraged by the idea that any single nation, let alone the United States, should enjoy global domination. The French foreign minister, Hubert Védrine, termed the United States a hyperpower and scorned its arrogance.